Let me start by telling you a story of a species that was asleep. And when it woke up, it saw the doom that it had created already for so many other species, and that it had now trapped itself on a path towards, a path of self-imposed death. It saw its own doom, and it trembled in fear, and it wept. But then it realized that it wasn't fully awake yet. There was a further step it had to take to become awakened, to become enlightened. And that was to realize, hang on a minute, we're not spectators of this. This story isn't over yet. It's wrong to tell it as if it's over. We can rebel against this doom, against this path to extinction. If we see clearly what we've done, the state we're in, the path ahead, the doom that seems inevitable, well, that seeing is the beginning of the one and only way in which it might yet not be inevitable. Because we're not spectators. We are agents. We are potential agents of change, and we have no idea what we are capable of until we try. We can rebel against the very predictable results of our present path. If we dare to look the reality of what we've done to life on Earth and what we've done to our very climate in the face, then two things. Firstly, we can prepare for our possible doom. And if we're potentially going to fail to prevent that doom, as looks objectively probable, then we'd better get on with preparing to meet it. And secondly, we can prepare ourselves to seek to give our all to prevent it. This talk is about those two kinds of preparations, about adaptation to a possible coming fate, and about the heroic attempt to prevent that fate. This talk is about how it looks like we're doomed, but also about how it only looks like that only if we only look. If we picture ourselves as spectators. But if instead we step into our full power as agents of change, capable of extraordinary, beautiful, unprecedented, unknowable things, then objective assessment of probabilities suddenly all becomes moot. And instead, it's about our freedom to create something new, something historic, something glorious, right in the teeth of the darkness of this time. But first, why think that a sober assessment of probabilities would lead us to conclude that we are doomed? Won't international action save us from climate catastrophe? No. Sorry, the answer is no. Let me spend a little while talking with you about why the Paris Climate Change Agreement will not save us. So the Paris Climate Change Agreement, a few years ago now, was an absolutely historic, unprecedented, extraordinary diplomatic achievement. Every country in the world had to agree for this climate agreement to be made, and they did. And what they agreed to was really about the most that you could expect the countries of the world all together to agree to. They agreed to work together to make changes to reduce our carbon emissions so that we don't destroy ourselves. Very good so far. But there are some problems, some very, very big problems, which I'm now going to briefly outline. So let's start with the fact that this was a few years ago. What have we had since then? Since then, we've had growing scientific evidence of how desperate our plight is, including, for example, the huge amount of heat that's trapped in the oceans, much huger than we realize, which is committing us to further dangerous climate change for a long time to come. We've seen our weather start to really spiral out of control just in those last few years since Paris, and that's part of what's waking a lot of people up to what's happening. And perhaps worst of all, we've seen absolutely incredibly at this moment in history, we've seen the election of Donald Trump in the USA and of Bolsonaro in Brazil about the two worst leaders you could possibly imagine in about the two most important countries in the entire world for dealing with this awesome crisis. So things have got a lot worse since the Paris Agreement was signed, tragically, on balance. But it's worse than that, because even on its own terms, the Paris Agreement is profoundly inadequate to the situation that we're in. Firstly, the Paris Agreement basically aims to keep our global climate to within 2 degrees of overheat compared to pre-industrial levels. But most scientists think that isn't actually a safe level. That's why more recently they've been talking about 1.5 degrees, which is pretty much of an impossible target. So even what Paris is aiming for is not enough. The way that Paris intends us to get there is through voluntary contributions to that target by countries around the world. Voluntary contributions, bit of a worry there. And those contributions, you add them all up, and people have done this, and they add up to considerably less than is necessary to keep us within 2 degrees. They probably take us to somewhere around 3 degrees of global overheat. It doesn't end there. Unfortunately, these are simply targets. These are aspirations made, as I say, voluntarily by the governments of the world. But you have to ask yourself this question. If those aspirations run up against other plans that those governments have, which is going to win? So one way of posing the question is to think of it like this. On the one hand, you've got the climate change minister saying, well, look, we signed up to these targets in Paris. And on the other hand, you've got the business minister and the Chancellor of the Exchequer saying, yeah, and this is what we need for economic growth and infrastructure development and so on. Now, when you have the climate change minister on the one hand arguing against the Chancellor of the Exchequer and the business minister on the other hand, well, I leave it to you to figure out who's going to win that one. Most countries of the world, just about all countries in the world, have plans for industrial growth, for economic growth, for infrastructure growth, which directly contradict their voluntary agreement under the Paris Climate Change Agreement. Extremely worrying. But that's not the end of it. The IPCC process itself, the UN process itself, needs to be critiqued. You may not be aware that the summary documents which the IPCC comes up with are not produced by scientists. They're produced by, or at least they're edited, by politicians and civil servants. This is not an objective process. Moreover, even the IPCC bit, the scientists bit themselves, the scientists have to agree among themselves, and this is a kind of process of a sort of lowest common denominator. Mostly what you have in the IPCC reports is a sort of bare minimum of what we can expect in terms of how bad things are going to be. Leading edge predictions of how bad things could be rarely get in there, and it's those that we should be worried about now. Why is that? Well, another reason why the IPCC process itself is problematic is because it doesn't take proper account of feedbacks. In the recent 1.5 degree report, for example, there was virtually nothing about the fact that the Arctic ice cap, as you probably know, is melting. And this is meaning that there is less whiteness reflecting the sun's rays out back into space again. I mean, you're starting to get a vicious feedback there. As more of the sun's rays come in and hit dark sea, more of them get absorbed, and that increases the temperature further, and then more ice melts, and you see where that's going. That's not even the scariest feedback. The scariest feedback, which is completely ignored almost in the IPCC process, is the potential methane feedback. As we melt the permafrost, especially, and some of that, and as we melt ice also under the seabed, we are starting to release significant amounts of methane. Methane is a greenhouse gas that is somewhere between 25 and 86 times, depends how you calculate, as powerful as carbon dioxide. And some scientists are worried that once this methane effect starts really going, it will be uncontrollable and we'll have runaway climate change. You put all these points together, and what it suggests is that on the Paris trajectory, we're headed for something like 4 degrees, 5 degrees of global overheat, probably this century. That is incompatible with civilization as we know it. That is incompatible with an industrial growth-based society. And I haven't even mentioned possibly the worst thing of all, the really dirty secret about the Paris Agreement, which is to reach its targets later on this century, it presupposes that we will use the technologies of so-called climate engineering or geoengineering the idea that we can engineer the climate of the whole planet, an extremely, how should we put it, bold ambition that our failures to date perhaps shouldn't encourage us to think is very likely to be well succeeded in. There are two problems with the technologies proposed for this bold ambition. The first is that they don't exist. And that's more or less a literal statement of fact. The only ones that do exist haven't been trialed at scale, and there's very little reason to believe that they would work at scale. Secondly, if they were used at scale, if they were trialed, well, it would be an extremely, extremely reckless thing to do. We're talking about things like putting mirrors in space. We're talking about things like attempting to suck vast amounts of carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere, or attempting to replicate natural cloud effects with artificial clouds that could radically alter our weather. These technologies, these techno fixes, are incredibly dangerous and reckless. So the first problem with these technologies, which are presupposed by the Paris Agreement, is that they don't exist. And the second problem is that if they did exist, we almost certainly shouldn't use them. So what conclusion should one draw from this? Well, I already said it. If we stick to what's intended under the Paris Agreement, then during this century and possibly during the next generation, this civilization will be finished. Industrial growth society will be over. We're talking about collapse. We're talking about the potential for a series of events which will make the Second World War look relatively minor. We're talking about multiple holocausts. There's no way to sugar this pill. This is not a drill. This is not an academic exercise. This is about whether we, and especially anyone younger than about 30 or 40 in this room, has a future. Industrial growth society is finished. It is doomed. Look at this incredible picture. This is California late last year. Comment is kind of superfluous, really. That is where we're headed, that and a lot worse. If we manage to go along with what is intended under the Paris Agreement, right? Never mind if we don't achieve it. You see what I'm saying? The best ambitions that our governments have for us mean that the societies that they run are finished. They are not going to be sustained. They are doomed. But does the fact that they are doomed have to mean that we are doomed? That is the question that we now must turn to. It seems to me that in this situation, there are three possibilities. There are three realistic possibilities for the form that the end of industrial growth society will take. It's going to happen. Which of these three scenarios will play out? The first scenario I've already gestured at, that our societies will collapse completely, that this incredibly thin layer, which is our atmosphere, will continue to heat up. And that will not be compatible with life as we know it. In particular, the first thing that is likely to give, although there are many possibilities, is our food systems. We already got a little hint of that last summer. Imagine if the heat wave that we'd had last summer had gone on, as it quite easily could have done, on into September. We were already getting major crop losses. One little example, onion crop in East Anglia down 25 to 30%. How many summers like that can the vast numbers that we have sustain? This is the first possibility, and I put it first because objectively it now looks like it's the most likely. But here's the second possibility, and this may not sound great, but actually I think it's quite exciting in some ways, and quite realistic. Maybe we will manage to seed a successor society to it, to what we have, as this society collapses. And that is now something that we have to give serious attention to thinking about. It's not enough anymore to pretend that if we just keep trying to mitigate climate change in the way we have been doing, that we are going to succeed in saving ourselves and saving some version of this society, we have to consider the possibility of some kind of massive collapse event. And we have to think about how we can try to help whatever comes after that, if anything comes after that, if we manage to have anything come after that, if we don't get some kind of runaway dangerous climate change produced by the methane feedback, for example. We have to think about what that could be like and how we could foster it. So what is this a picture of? This is a picture of the seed bank at Svalbard, which some of you will be aware of, which tries to keep seeds, large numbers of diverse seeds, intact for possible future generations to use after some kind of collapse event. Now, tragically, what happened recently, as some of you will have heard, is that the Svalbard seed bank started to melt. Because Svalbard, many of you will know about Svalbard, for example, from Philip Pullman's marvelous Northern Lights book. Land of snow and ice, but the Arctic has been exposed to these absolutely insane temperatures over the last year, 20 or 30 degrees above seasonal normals. So the seed bank started to melt and emergency work was needed to keep it intact. We have to think about how to keep this kind of thing intact, how to do it even more creatively. Various ways, this is just an example of how we can try to help whoever may come after us if this society collapses to rebuild something different and better. That's the second possibility, and I'm saying we need to think about it more than we have done so far. The third possibility, this society will somehow manage to transform itself. We will somehow manage to transform ourselves radically and rapidly in an unprecedented manner in time to avert collapse. So, industrial growth society as we know it is finished. But that doesn't have to mean that there has to be a collapse event in which there are multiple holocausts. It could be averted if we do something completely unprecedented. And that's what I call transformation. So, we should aim for this possibility, number three, but we should also, as an insurance policy, take action that conduces to possibility number two being available and to try to avoid at all costs possibility number one. So those three possibilities, which are we going to plump for? What is to be done? Given this situation, what is to be done? I'm going to suggest seven things that we need to do in this unprecedented historic challenge that we now face. Firstly, there we go. Wake up, freak out. Hopefully you're already doing a bit of that, the very fact that you're here, and then the fact you've heard what I've said so far. And of course, it's not enough just for you as an individual to wake up. Try to get all your friends and family and workmates, teachers, whoever it might be, to wake up and to freak out as well. The more of us who do it together, the more of an impact there's going to be. This is not something which is easy to do, by the way. It's not a kind of one-off event. It's very easy to think, well, yeah, I've woken up to this. I've acknowledged that this is the reality. And then to keep on sliding back into the assumption that we can just sort of go on with our lives most of the time in the same way that we do. If you're really going to do this, it's going to require a lot of thought, a lot of concentration, and then starting to think about which of your practices you want to change. You know, what things do you want to give up? What things do you want to, for example, maybe do now rather than later? Because there might not be a later in the way you've imagined. Secondly, so I've already gestured at this, work to transform the society, including through what my think tank Greenhouse, following the UN, calls transformative adaptation. Why am I talking about transformative adaptation? What does that mean? Well, as I've already said, it is no longer enough for us to think, when we think about dangerous climate change, only about climate mitigation. That is no longer credible. We are now committed to dangerous climate change, which is going to get worse for a long time to come, whatever we do, even if we do the absolute best we can. Because as I gestured at a little while ago, there are time lags in the system. There is this vast amount of heat in the ocean. Methane lasts 20, 25 years in the atmosphere. Carbon dioxide lasts hundreds of years in the atmosphere. If we were to stop all emissions tomorrow, the climate situation would go on getting worse for a considerable time to come, right? It is not credible anymore to think, yes, we just have to solve this problem. We just have to stop producing so many emissions. No, we are going to have to adapt. And we're going to have to adapt in this way, which we call transformative, because the kind of shallow adaptation, the kind of mainstream adaptation, which is involved in doing things like just building higher dikes or seawalls, for example, to deal with flood risks, that isn't good enough. Why isn't that good enough? Firstly, it's not good enough because it's actually productive itself of greenhouse gas emissions, right? We have to think of ways of adapting which are simultaneously ways of mitigating if we're not going to make the situation worse and worse, yeah? We can't adapt in ways that are themselves fossil fuel heavy. And secondly, we have to be fleet-footed in our adaptation. We have to try to create a society which is going to be ready for continual change in our climate and difficult situations for a long time to come. We are in the early stages of a very long emergency. And to get through that emergency, we're going to have to adapt to the difficult changes that are coming, and we're going to have to do so transformatively, in a way that ultimately transforms our society into the kind of flourishing, very different society that we need. But that actually isn't enough. We also have to accept that this effort to transform society may well fail. Because as I started out by sketching, the situation is very grim, and we are facing massive forces of ignorance, massive forces of vested interests which are going to find it very difficult to adapt. We have to face the reality that we've left this all awfully late. We may well fail. We may well fail to transformatively adapt, let alone to mitigate adequately. Therefore, we also need what my friend and colleague Jim Bendel calls deep adaptation. What is deep adaptation? Adaptation that is deep is adaptation that accepts, at least hypothetically, that collapse is probable, or highly probable, or some people, they think it's inevitable. So deep adaptation says, what if we do experience a collapse event? What then? So this is like the kind of thinking that I talked about a few minutes ago when I talked about we have to think about how to seed a successor civilization. So deep adaptation says things like, okay, if society does start to collapse, what kind of things will we need to do to stop that collapse from becoming self-fulfilling, from becoming worse and worse? So here's one very prominent example. Some people think that nuclear power is a way which we might be able to help ourselves solve the problem of greenhouse gas emissions and high fossil fuel use and growth in global temperatures. But when you look at the issue that we're facing from the perspective of thinking, we have to start to face up to the possibility that there may well be some kind of collapse event, nuclear power starts to look completely different, right? Because nuclear power produces waste that remains toxic for, well, hundreds of thousands of years, and highly toxic for hundreds of years. And it needs to be carefully guarded during that period. I don't just mean guarded against terrorists, although that's obviously one thing it needs to be guarded against. I mean, you've got literally rods of spent fuel, which are in pools, and these pools have to be kept there constantly. If the pool goes dry, then within about 12 to 24 hours, the spent fuel rods will catch fire. And if they catch fire and the fire is not put out, the fires will burn for decades or hundreds of years, spewing toxic waste into the atmosphere. So picture some kind of collapse event across Russia, say, where suddenly all the nuclear power stations are abandoned and they cease to have power going to them, they cease to be maintained. In very, very short order, you get not only meltdowns of cores of nuclear power stations, but just the waste that is left over starts to become an unbelievably potent and horrendous health hazard for ourselves and our non-human kin. This is the kind of thing that we need to be thinking about now if we seriously believe, as I've suggested we must, that collapse is objectively probable, or at least something which we need to very seriously consider. So we need to be thinking now about how to make these nuclear power stations safe, not for God's sake building more, and about how we can make nuclear waste relatively safe. That is a prime example of deep adaptation. Deep adaptation is sort of an ultimate insurance policy. It says, given that we now cannot rule out, at the very least, we cannot rule out that there may be some kind of major prolonged collapse event, partially or completely, We need to be taking steps now to try to put ourselves and whoever comes after us in the best possible position to survive that kind of event. So that's the third thing. Not just transformative adaptation, but deep adaptation. Fourthly, well, by this point in the talk, maybe you're upset. Maybe you're feeling angry. Maybe you're feeling grief. Maybe you're feeling terror. Well, whatever it is, feel it. And this is one of the very things which I think is very exciting about Extinction Rebellion, that it has gone against the mainstream in environmental thinking. For so long, people have been saying things like, oh, we've got to tell a positive story, we've got to remain optimistic, we've got to convince everybody that we can change everything for the better, and it's not going to be that difficult. And if we all just make a real effort and put in low-energy light bulbs, then basically everything's going to be fine. And even if it's not, we've got to pretend that it is, because if you get people scared, they will turn off, they'll become apathetic. No, forget all of that. Now is the time for authenticity. Now is the time for telling the truth. Now is the time for being real about how bad this is and using our feelings, right? And not just pretending that some kind of rational policy wonk fantasy is going to solve this, because it's not. So feel your anger, feel your grief, whatever it is, feel your despair. Don't get stuck in it, but feel it, and then work through it. Feel your terror. And when you've done all that, then you're in the best position to do this. Rebel. The time is now for mass, nonviolent, direct action. We've tried plenty of other stuff, and I'm not saying don't do that other stuff. Yeah, sure. Continue to write to your MP, continue to lobby, continue obviously to try to live lightly upon the earth yourselves. Rob mentioned that I'm in the Green Party. I think that ordinary political action continues to be very important. I personally would say to you, join the Green Party, vote Green, stand for election, whatever. That's all really, really good. It's all really, really necessary. We need everything. But don't be fooled into thinking that those things alone, those conventional things, are going to be enough. They're not going to be enough. We need an absolute step change. We need it rapidly, and we need it for a long time. And the best idea that we have is this. The best idea that we have is to say, the societies that are committing us to oblivion, the governments that are committing us to oblivion, the governments that are planning, when you look at the realities of the Paris Climate Change Accord, that are planning for the self-destruction of the societies which they've created and which we depend upon, these governments are no longer legitimate, right? How can a government be legitimate which is engaged in a sort of mass criminal conspiracy to not only destroy even more of the non-human life on Earth? We've destroyed half the non-human life on Earth during my lifetime. And it's so unbelievable and so tragic. You can say it as many times as you like, and it's almost impossible to compute. So there's that, and then the fact that we are now putting ourselves on the endangered species list. How can such governments expect us to go along with their laws any longer? It is time, it is high time, it is past time for us to say no, and for us to be freed up from the assumptions of political business as usual by the awesome horror of the situation that we now find ourselves in. So, into this space, Extinction Rebellion have stepped, and thank goodness that we have. So here's an image from one of the bridges. That's Westminster Bridge. At the big day when we took the bridges, 6,000 of us, 6,000 people engaging in non-violent civil disobedience. This is pretty much unprecedented in British political history. Another of our actions, maybe some of you are in this picture, I was about there, and this was the day when we occupied the street outside Parliament and blocked the entrance to Parliament, and did a lot more besides. Very, very exciting, very, very empowering. People realizing, oh, right, we can, if there's enough of us, it's really hard for the police to deal with us and stop us, especially now that their numbers have been cut quite a lot. You know, I know we're not supposed to like austerity and cuts some, but it sometimes has upsides. Here's the demands of Extinction Rebellion. In simple terms, demand number one is tell the truth, which is what I've been trying to do here and what we all need to do. The government should tell the truth. That's why also I was so passionate last year in trying to get the BBC to start telling the truth on climate and not featuring the absolute absurdities of climate change deniers any longer as balance. And the BBC have really changed their ways quite a lot over the last year. They're still way short of where they need to be, but they've gone quite a long way in the right direction. Let's keep pushing them in that direction. Anyway, demand number one says, get the government to tell the truth. Demand number two says, we want to reduce carbon emissions in the UK to net zero by 2025. Wow, that is a real target. That is a serious ambition. If the Paris Agreement were to say something like that, then it would have some credibility in terms of actually rising to the task that we face. It's absolutely eye-watering. How would something like that be done? You couldn't do something like that by just switching to electric cars or something. Reducing to zero by 2025 in a country like this, it means things like just shutting down a whole load of power stations. It means things like just melting down a whole load of cars and turning them into something else. Doesn't mean we have to go back to living in caves. Now, don't accept any rubbish like that if anyone says to you, oh, you want us to go living in caves and sit around a candle. It's so boring. They say the same thing over and over. It's always a cave and a candle. Doesn't mean that. We can still have plenty of renewable energy and so on and so forth, but it's going to mean big changes in our way of life. It's going to mean a lot of our existing infrastructure is just going to have to go. As I say, industrial growth society as we know it is at an end. The only question is it going to be ended by an enraged nature destroying it, or is it going to be ended by us voluntarily in an extraordinary action of rapid transformation? And the third demand is very interesting. The third demand says, conventional democracy has failed. What we need to do is have some kind of citizens' assembly or citizens' assemblies picked at random from the public, like juries are picked at random from the public, and then given some education and helpful support and so on. We need citizens' assemblies to be involved in making the decisions about how we go about doing all of this. We need to take it out of, to some extent at least, of the hands of professional politicians and professional civil servants and get the people involved. I think this is a very exciting and important part of what Extinction Rebellion is calling for. And Extinction Rebellion, as we've heard, is doing stuff locally as well. There's yours truly at the first non-violent direct action that we did here in Norwich, where we occupied this exhibition that the council had where they were trying to tell people about this wonderful new road that they want to build. Spoiler alert, it's not wonderful. They want to build a road across this beautiful valley near here, the Wensum Valley, and basically destroy the peace and calm of it and destroy much of the wildlife and, of course, create loads of new journeys, loads of new cars, at the exact time when we need to be massively reducing our carbon emissions. It's completely absurd, total lack of vision. So here's some of the people who are in this room tonight blocking this exhibition, and we achieved a pretty remarkable and really quite positive set of media coverages out of it. This is the very clever Norwich Extinction Rebellion symbol. One or two of you probably recognize what's being riffed on there. And it's not just Extinction Rebellion, by the way. I want to mention one other thing that's happening right now, which is also very exciting, of this kind of radical, unprecedented nature. Some of you may recognize the young woman on the left. She's 15 years old. She's called Greta Thunberg. She's a Swedish school student, and she started a strike because of climate change. She said, why should I go to school if the education that I'm getting is going to be irrelevant because society is going to fall apart by the time I'm middle-aged? And at first it was just her. Things have changed a bit since then. 30,000 young people, this is just one of many, many demonstrations taken to the streets. Most of those are school students. Now, one thing that's really exciting about this, some of you probably know some children, some of you probably have some children. There is a starting now of the School Strike for Climate movement here in this country. And the first big day of action is coming right up. It's February the 15th. So if you know a kid or if you have a kid, I would suggest to you say something subversive to them. Yeah? Say to them, yeah, you know, why should you go to school every single day to be taught this irrelevant stuff if society is going to fall apart by the time you're old? It's a horrible thing that we have to contemplate saying this kind of thing to our children. It's abominable. But that is the situation we are now in. And we're starting to get to a situation where we're getting inspired by the leadership of young people who are willing to face up to this. So that's, this, I think, goes right alongside what's happening in Extinction Rebellion. All right, so that was number five. We need to rebel. Number six, we need to talk. So in the not too distant future, I'm going to stop because it's really, really important that we get to discuss about this. This is not a topic where it makes any sense at all to have a lecture and then to just go straight off back to your own home by yourself. You need to talk. We need to talk about this because this stuff needs to be processed emotionally, rationally, practically. It needs to not be something that gets stuck inside your head. For far too long, that's a situation that far too many of us have been in. I think that many people have been in a situation for quite a long time of kind of having this set of worries at a low level, but not really fully addressing it. We're trying to find ways of kind of coping with it that involve things like, you know, trying to study it a bit and share your worries a bit, but not too much. You don't want to make people too worried themselves. You don't want to sound like you're some kind of kook. Well, you're not a kook. This is real. And my experience is that since I started giving this kind of talk, it's actually been hugely liberating for me and hugely liberating for quite a lot of people that I've talked to. It took me a long time to get to the point of being willing to give this kind of talk because I was so intimidated by all the voices that were saying for so many years, you must remain optimistic, you mustn't put people off, people are going to be demoralized, people are going to be angry with you, etc. I was worried that I'd be attacked in public for giving this kind of talk at all. My actual experience has been very, very different. That over and over again, what people have said to me is, oh, thank God, we can actually be honest about this now. We can actually start facing it. We can actually start talking about it among ourselves. So that's what we need to do. And that isn't a quick process either. Here's a quote which may be helpful. Paul Kingsnorth, who saw a lot of this coming, this is from his brilliantly titled book, Confessions of a Recovering Environmentalist. There is an abyss opening up before us. Challenges everything we thought we knew about our culture and nature. We need to look into it and concentrate on what we can see. And that leads me to my seventh and final point on the list of the things that I think we should do. We need to stop. It's not just enough to throw yourself straight into direct action or whatever it might be. We need to stop. We need to pause. We need to kind of take stock. If we don't do that, then we won't do all the other things on the list. In particular, we won't really properly wake up. So do a little bit of that now, do a little bit of that later. Build it into your work, your processing of all of this. So in the course of that, I've put up a blank slide here, a little moment of nothingness. What's going on with the lion? Well, I want to end by saying this. I think that when we do these seven things, we're in a position to do something extraordinary. The real challenge that Extinction Rebellion brings us is a challenge which is not just a political or a practical one. It's also a kind of psychological one and a spiritual one. I want to use the word spiritual as well, even if some of you might think, I'm not too sure about whether I'm a spiritual person. What do I mean by it being a spiritual challenge? It's about who we are in our deepest reality. It's about bringing all of us to the party, our minds, our emotions, our souls. This is what I think we're able to do if we do the seven things that I sketched. We face reality. We have the courage to see what is coming. We have the courage to see what already is in its full horror. And then we rise up to meet it. That, I think, is the remarkable, extraordinary and in many ways very exciting challenge that now faces us. This is a terrible, horrendous time to be alive, all right? And it's also a wonderful, historic time to be alive. How could you be more lucky than to be alive at the time when you might be able to be part of changing the fate of humanity away from what seems to be an inevitable path to doom to something better, to at least stop that doom from being complete and catastrophic, and to give people who come after us, who come after a collapse perhaps, some kind of chance of a future, and maybe to manage to transform things completely. If we really look into that abyss, I believe that we can do this. And in that case, what happens, I think, is that our ecological perception, our perception of how things are, of how bad things are, of being willing to look reality in the eye, our ecological perception, our spiritual and psychological awakening, our true waking up, and our socio-political uprising, which has at the center of it, I think, Extinction Rebellion. These are all aspects of the same thing. The arising consciousness that we are rises to meet what it faces that's wrong. And however bad things get, that is possible. However bad things get, it's possible to look at them and accept that that's how they are and be clear that they have to change. So however bad things get, we can rise up to meet them and change them and overcome them. We can do this if we do it together. And if we do, they will hear our lions roar. They will hear it. Come to London on the 15th of April, Monday the 15th of April. Please put this date in your diary. If anything I'm saying is resonating with you, this is the most important day nationally. What we're hoping to do on this day is like what we did on the Day of the Bridges, but with 4-5 times as many people. If that happens, there will be no precedent for it whatsoever in the entire history of this country. And what we intend for that to be is the beginning of our nonviolent rebellion. This word rebellion, this is not just a joke or a metaphor. This is intended literally. This is intended to say what we want to do is put in process a chain of events which will nonviolently radically change the direction of this country. And then that will hopefully echo around the world and be replicated elsewhere in the world. Nothing less than that is what's going to be necessary if we are going to have any chance of the third option I sketched for you earlier, the option of transformation. So please, if you haven't already done so, plan on being in London all day on the 15th of April. You don't have to be willing to get arrested even. And if there are 30,000 of us there, believe you me, it will be absolutely impossible for them to arrest us all. Thank you very much. Thank you for your really intense attention, which I've been feeling. Here's a few things that you might want to record. And in particular, I want to draw attention to this, the book that will be out in a couple of months' time, our book, Facing Up to Climate Reality, which we think is going to be quite innovative because it's going to be doing, obviously, exactly the kind of thing I've been doing in this talk, but in detail, working through the kinds of sectors that we need to think about in order to actually do this. So there's a chapter on history, there's a chapter on the precautionary principle, a chapter on geoengineering, a chapter on despair, and so on. And that really is it. Thank you so much. We're ready to talk. Great question, thank you. So the idea in April is that April the 15th will be the start, and that if the numbers are strong enough, if the will is strong enough, that people will potentially remain in the streets, remain active on the days that follow that. And as I said, the concept of rebellion here is not intended as a metaphor. It is intended literally. The idea is supposed to be that we no longer accept the full legitimacy and the legal legitimacy of governments which are condemning us to a catastrophic future, and that we're going to resist that non-violently. In this way, obviously, trying to follow in the footsteps of people such as Martin Luther King, Gandhi, the suffragettes. A lot of this is detailed in Gail Bradbrook's video. Part of the way that is intended to work is that if you get a lot of people rebelling and being willing to take the consequences of their action in terms of being arrested, in terms of being imprisoned and so on, then you may start to generate quite a lot of sympathy with these people, who some people will start to think are being unjustly arrested, unjustly imprisoned. And then you try to build your level of sympathy and support. In order to achieve the kind of very radical change we're talking about. You don't necessarily need everybody, which is a good thing. You don't necessarily need even a majority. What you need is a really sort of determined minority, and then a much broader group who are willing to give them some support and sympathy. I can't give you a detailed game plan, partly because there isn't one, partly because even if there is one, I'd have to kill you if I told it to you. But also, look, a lot of this is about is the way that Extinction Rebellion works is highly decentralized, actually. So the call for the big day in London, obviously that's something which is crucial and has to be coordinated nationally. But a lot of what Extinction Rebellion now is doing is working on a local level, and it's working in terms of people who are coming together in affinity groups like here at UEA to try to do something in common. So this action, you know, we dreamed this up. No one in the central Extinction Rebellion offices or whatever told us to. We decided to do it. Like I say, I think it could be pretty exciting and pretty radical. I hope that goes some way to answering your question. Yeah, thank you. Next, yes?
To what extent is the problem the human population, and to what extent is the solution making it so we don't have as many people in future? And to follow on to that, what sort of the maximum or equilibrium point of human population with the changes being proposed?
Yeah. Right, so this is obviously a controversial question, very interesting question. Different people have different views. I'll give you an outline of my view on it. My view is that it's clear in the first place that the central problem is not the human population. The central problem is the human population multiplied by the level at which we are living and the level at which we are consuming. Another way of putting that is to say that insofar as we have a population problem, the population problem is worst in countries like this one, not in countries like China, let alone places in Africa. The problem is worst, in other words, not where there are most people, but where there are most people who are living in a highly energy profligate, carbon profligate, ecologically profligate way. Having said that, I think it's obvious that the more people there are, the more you fragilize the situation, the more likely you are to have the kind of problems that we're having. And obviously, all over the world, wildlife is suffering because of human population and arguably human overpopulation. What is the actual human carrying capacity of the planet? That's much debated. My own view is that it's likely to be lower than our present population. What we need to try to do is to stop the population from growing too much and reduce the population, if possible, in ways which don't involve people dying horrible deaths. I mean, that's a very obvious point. That is now the challenge that we face. We know that there are some win-wins on this. There are making contraceptives more available. There are educating women in societies where women are oppressed into thinking that they have to have large families, and so on and so forth. But I want to also come back to the point where I started. Don't ever be fooled into thinking that population is the cause of the problem. The population only really has a devastating effect when it is multiplied by living at a kind of level which is not sustainable. Industrial growth society is the real heart of the trouble, in my opinion.
How do you actually stop people wanting to consume?
How do you stop people wanting to consume? Oh, wow. Yeah, another really easy one. So again, there's huge amounts to say about that, and there are other people in the room who I know have views on it. I'm going to call on you in a moment, Teresa. My own view is that part of the way that you stop people wanting to consume or wanting to overconsume is you give them other stuff to want and to care about, which is more meaningful. And actually, I want to take that directly back to what we've been talking about, right? I think that if we could encourage more of us to be spending more of our time thinking about, right, how are we going to enable our children to have a future, right? How are we going to enable ourselves to have a future? What should we be doing in that cause? Well, among the things we should be doing in that cause are not overconsuming and throwing ourselves into activism with Extinction Rebellion and so on and so forth. You give people a kind of different focus and a different purpose, everything starts to flow from that. Teresa, what would you add? You've written a book about this.
Yes, my book's called Happier People, Healthier Planet, How Putting Wellbeing First Would Help Sustain Life on Earth. And my contention is that we're destroying the natural world by overconsumption, but pursuing consumption, the whole economy is based on more and more consumption. So people come under more and more pressure to consume in all sorts of different ways, and advertisers know our weaknesses, our weak points, and play on them. But in fact, well-being isn't served by overconsumption. Well-being is served by all sorts of what I would call non-material assets. So first and foremost, good relationships, but also creativity, a sense of meaning, contact with the natural world, a sense of community. And we need, as individuals and as a society, to invest in these assets.
Yep.
And then it'll turn our attention away from the quick hit of consumption. Because, yep, in fact, looking outside ourselves and being active in the world, looking right inside ourselves, being creative, actually is far more fulfilling. Satisfying, and we need to refocus our society on these things.
Yeah, and the great thing is that those kinds of things, like building community, focusing on relationships, etc., they are modelled by the kind of activism that we need now, such as in Extinction Rebellion, and the kind of transformed society that we need to avoid having a collapse. Again, he's going to have that kind of character anyway. So there is a potential sort of win-win-win here, if we can only see our way towards it. One of the crucial ways, as Teresa has said, in which we can undermine the seemingly unstoppable momentum of the consume, consume, consume message is to enable people to understand this is not making people happy. You know, there is a huge mental health crisis gripping societies like this one. And believe you me, you ain't seen nothing yet in terms of a mental health crisis. You know, probably a lot of people in this room are suffering around thinking about the extinctions we're inflicting on other animals, thinking in fear about their own future. Some of us have suffered mental ill health as a result of that. Well, we're just a kind of leading edge of something much, much bigger in that regard. But we could start to turn that around if we start to reforge community, reforge our purpose, rebuild in a more local way our society, which has been so atomized and so torn apart by marketing, by capitalism, by growth. So I think there is actually quite a lot of hope in response to your very important question. Thank you. More questions. Right at the back.
Do you think that your dismissal of nuclear earlier was an example of the environmentalist movement shooting itself in the foot? Because nuclear is such an important resource for us right now to have carbon-free energy, that if we just got rid of it and relied on solar and wind, we would not make the cuts that we need to make, let alone 2025 carbon neutral.
So what's your answer to my set of remarks about nuclear? That it is utterly irresponsible to be creating more nuclear power at a time when we cannot guarantee, as we need to guarantee that all of that waste and all of those power plants remain safe for the next few centuries. Nearly all of those power plants are located on coastlines. Global overheat, anyone? Sea level rise, anyone? What's your answer to that?
My answer is that planning just for collapse seems like a privilege.
It's not planning just for collapse, but we have to have an insurance policy. We have to have an insurance policy.
But what's our insurance policy for preventing the collapse? I mean, today, 20% of the energy produced in this country was renewables.
Yeah, okay, so let me answer that. Let me answer that. Our insurance policy there is we have to use less energy, right? We have to start descending in energy terms, not thinking we can grow and grow and grow. And we have to be putting our effort into renewable energy, and we have to be putting our effort into energy efficiency and demand reduction and so on and so forth. That's what we need to be doing. It is profoundly irresponsible, I believe. I don't think, you say, do I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot? I think it would be we'd be shooting ourselves in the head if we carried on building more nuclear at this point in history. We have to start taking seriously the possibility of collapse. You cannot guarantee to me that possibility is not going to occur, because I've given you ample reason to believe that unless we do something incredible, it is going to occur. We can't. It's completely irresponsible to think, all right, well, we're just gonna bet on it not occurring, even though there's overwhelming reason to believe it's going to occur. That's my answer.
I think that's still a privilege. Thinking about planning for collapse is a privilege at this point. We need to be fighting to stop.
I honestly don't understand what you're talking about. How is that a privilege? The situation that we are in is in a profoundly unprivileged one, in the sense that if we are going to be honest with ourselves, we have to look in the face the kind of stuff that I started talking about. The Paris Agreement is probably committing us to the collapse of industrial growth civilization within about 30 to 40 years, right? In that context, you cannot say we must at all costs make sure that we do not collapse. We cannot be certain that we're not going to. In fact, we probably are going to in some form or another. That's nothing to do with privilege. That's reality. That's facing reality. No, we need to move on now. Thank you. You made your point.
Yeah, how can we reach out to people on the right or in the centre who might see this as like a perceived contradiction to their fundamental political views?
Yeah, it's a tricky one. Very, very tricky one. There's a limit to which we can do it, frankly, but there are ways in which we can do it. So consider people, for example, who vote for the Conservative Party. Well, a lot of people who vote for the Conservative Party, they think of themselves as conservative. What they want to do, they want to conserve things as they are in some sense, right? Now, to some extent, I've suggested that's just impossible. But in another sense, it's not just impossible. They want to do things like they want to conserve the woodlands near where they live, right? They want to conserve certain things about their way of life. They want to conserve their village. They want to be confident that there is some kind of future that is in some way similar to what they know from the past that their children are going to have. Well, we can answer to some of that, right? What we can say is, look, if you don't start to take seriously the kind of things we're talking about, everything you know is going to be destroyed. There's going to be nothing conserved, right? I was just teaching my students the other day in my philosophy meets the arts class. I was just teaching them The Road, the film The Road, which is a really profound meditation on the possibility of collapse, which any of you haven't seen, I'd strongly recommend you to see it. And if possibility number one, the unadulterated collapse occurs, and that is quite likely at some point during this century, if we don't make a radical change of direction, nothing will be conserved. The world as we know it will be over. So that's part of what we can say to people on the right. If you actually mean it about conserving stuff, then don't keep on ripping up everything in the pursuit of growth, right? That pursuit of growth is a fool's errand. The Conservative Party, the right, has been taken over in recent years by people who don't really believe in conservative values. They believe in ripping everything up in the cause of ever higher profits. That is going to stop, and it's going to stop soon. Like I say, it'll either be stopped by nature or it'll be stopped voluntarily by us. Maybe some of those people can ally with us in helping it to stop voluntarily. Maybe they can help us create the radical transformation that we so badly need. I really hope so. Yes, sir.
I'm fascinated, Rupert, that you have hardly mentioned the law at all. I don't mean getting arrested, and I don't mean the copper in the picture. What I mean is that under the existing law and the national policy statements of 2011, we've got to have more nuclear power stations.
Well, yeah, sure. I mean, this is just one of many examples of what needs to change, right? I mean, if the kind of thing that we're trying to engender in April starts to happen and starts to take off, here's one possible scenario for how it might go. If we manage to start to create serious political and economic difficulties for this government, it may be that the government starts to engage in some kind of negotiation with us, I mean with Extinction Rebellion. And in that negotiation, there would be a million things potentially up for grabs. Excuse me. One of them would be the kind of thing you've just mentioned. There are numerous laws, right, which force us to do things that point in the wrong direction. There are numerous laws that in that sense need to be changed or ignored or whatever it is. And let's hope that we can get ourselves in a position where we get to start to do that.
Can I ask the other half of that question. That was 2011. Last October, the IPCC said we've only got 12 years in which to find our way down in the carbon to an acceptable future.
Yeah.
Well, it would take Sizewell C on the Suffolk coast at least 15 years of massive carbon emissions before it started producing a single watt of electricity. Do the math.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, there are, of course, numerous arguments against new nuclear, and that's a very powerful one. It actually isn't quick enough in the circumstances that we're in to actually give us the energy that we need anyway. But, yeah, as you'll have heard, it seems to me that we need to think, actually, if we possibly can, on a shorter timescale. This is one of the reasons why I'm really excited about the Extinction Rebellion demand for carbon neutral by 2025. It's what they call, in politics, an impossible demand, right? It can't be done unless you just rethink everything, unless you just throw out the business as usual completely and start to shut down parts of the economic system as we know it. That is actually the kind of thing we need to try to do. Anyone down the side? Yes. You, yes.
Given how England is supposed to be one of the most developed countries in the world, and it's taking you guys so long to get your things together.
Yeah.
Disproportionately, all the developing countries like Pakistan and India and Bangladesh, where we are disproportionately hit by global warming and climate change, and we are affected more by the corporate greed that is basically from companies from Europe and England.
Yeah.
What sort of plan is more implementable to those countries where people are dying today because of that? How do we start helping those people out first?
Yeah, well, thank you so much. So, in terms of helping people in India, Bangladesh, and so on, the obvious first thing to say is there needs to be massive technology transfer, free green technology transfer. So what we ought to be doing is giving the infrastructure to those countries on a large scale now, such that they don't have to try to pass through the path of industrial development, which is now impossible. If everyone tries to pass through that path, we're just going to crash and collapse the entire system really, really quickly. So that's the first thing to say. Second thing to say, though, is I think a bit more complicated, that we actually do need to question this whole concept of development, right? And the idea that there's a sort of right to develop and that all countries in the world have this right, this needs to be questioned. Why? Well, firstly, because it's almost certain that it can't be done even if we have loads of green technology transfer without collapsing the world system. Remember that even green technology has significant ecological impacts and carbon impacts. You know, you've got to have a factory to make the wind turbines and so on and so on and so on. And secondly, because this concept of development, you know, this is one of the things which is really useful to have a very strong School of Development Studies at UEA for, to understand. This concept of development is itself profoundly dubious. It was essentially invented by President Truman and other Westerners to justify the export of the industrial growth model worldwide. That is the true history of development. It's not something which has been demanded by people in the global south. It's something that people in the global north try to impose upon people in the global south and say, this is what you want. And we can help you have it, and we'll profit by doing so. So part of what I think we need to do is we actually need to try to find ways of dialoguing with the global south in ways that, for example, involve the huge peasant communities and peasant movements in the global south. La Via Campesina, the largest organization on earth of peasants who basically say, we're happy being peasants, and we don't want you to impose your industrial agribusiness model upon us. And the world's remaining indigenous peoples, there's so much to learn from those peoples. And many of those peoples do not want to be developed, even in a good way. They want the right to remain in something like the way that they are, in something like the harmony with nature that they are. So there's a controversial claim, but I think it's inevitable if we're going to be serious about addressing the problem. Final point I'd make on this really, really crucial question is that you alluded to the fact that, of course, we've been doing this carbon pollution and so on for a long, long time. And of course, you're absolutely right. And that's why it's absolutely crucial for us, especially us in Britain. You know, it really did start here to take leadership on this issue. We need to say to the world, we are prepared to turn back from what we've done, from the terrible mistakes we've made. We are prepared to try to go carbon zero by 2025. Now, that's a very powerful way of saying we're giving up the supposed legacy and promise of industrialism. And we need to also say to the world, we're not all we're cracked up to be. You know, you look up to us or you look up to America, actually we're not that great. We're living in a completely unsustainable way and it doesn't even make us happy, to come back to the earlier question, yeah? It makes most of us, a lot of the time, pretty miserable, and that is almost certainly going to get worse for a long time to come. So if people around the world think, oh, I would really love to live in a country like Britain, it's so brilliant, the answer is no, it's not. And we need to be better at telling that story, at telling the story of how we're not all that we're cracked up to be. Yes?
Yeah, hi. One of my many worries about this is that climate is highly unpredictable, it seems, and that we could be very surprised quite rapidly. And it is happening in an environment where we are having to deal with the chaos of leaving the security of Europe, and we have individuals circling around us, such as Putin, and on the other side of the Atlantic we have the uncertainty of Trump, and parts of Europe are becoming increasingly right wing, and unless we have a powerful Extinction Rebellion political organisation that can prevent a vacuum being formed, which is then going to be fulfilled by right wing fascistic kind of government. This is a real worry that's kind of circling around within me, and I imagine within other people, and I wonder if you can give us some comments on that.
Yeah, good worry to have. No easy answers. Just to start where you started, I don't think we should assume it's inevitable that we're going to leave the EU. I don't think it is inevitable. I think no one knows what's going to happen. It's entirely possible we could remain in. Having said that, and you know, I would be in favour on balance of us remaining in the EU. The EU is awful, but leaving the EU would be even worse. As George Monbiot rightly said the other day, yeah, the issue of Brexit is important, and this issue is 1,000 times more important. Well, actually, it seems to me that's an underestimate. I mean, I think if history books are written, and unfortunately we can't say when anymore, if history books are written in the year 3000, no one's going to give a fig about whether Britain stays in the EU or not. What everyone's going to be talking about is, did they manage, and insofar as there are any history books to be written, they must have managed a bit to transform themselves, or at least to deeply adapt or something like that in the late 20th century. That this is the issue, what we're talking about here this evening, this is the issue on which our children are going to judge us. This is the issue on which we will stand or fall. This is the issue on which if we'll be able to either look ourselves in the mirror when we're about to die, or we won't be able to look ourselves in the mirror. So part of what I think we need to do is we need to try to respond to the very difficult situation that you paint by means of trying to inspire people around this issue. And as you imply, if Extinction Rebellion becomes a really massive thing, and if this country is the leading edge of it, and if it really starts to internationalize as it's starting to do, and we give people something to believe in, and we build a kind of powerful kind of alternative kind of center of gravity to the nonsense and rubbish around Trump and Putin for that matter, and so on and so forth. You know, that's the kind of way it seems to me that we can actually have hope in this incredibly difficult situation. So thanks, great question. Yeah.
I was gonna ask, you mentioned when I asked about population wanting to avoid horrible deaths, and you also talked about not necessarily assuming that there are people out there who are pre-industrial who want to be industrialized, which I think raises the question, how many people living now are alive because of a level of industrialization? For example, they're dependent on medicine that is not possible outside this model. I'd also say, the assumption that pre-industrialized people are in harmony with nature seems to ignore the fact that there are a lot of deaths there from things that are treatable at an industrial level.
I don't see how it ignores that at all. It doesn't ignore it, does it? It accepts it. But look, your question is a very interesting one. And I think there's two things to say about it. The first thing is, absolutely. There are people who are alive in this room. because of industrial growth society who would otherwise be dead. Now, what you have to then ask yourself the question is, does that fact make it legitimate for us to seek to perpetuate this society? Because it seems to me just obvious that it doesn't, right? Because if we try to perpetuate the society as it is, we will not succeed, and all we will end up doing is creating an even worse crash and collapse than we would otherwise have. And then no one's going to have those benefits. So, you know, let's try to kind of come out of the mindset of assuming that in some way or another we are going to be able to perpetuate what we have. We are not. So the more realistic question is, what of the things that we have are we going to be able to hang on to? So I would like it to be the case, for example, that we're able to hang on to most of modern medicine. I'd very much like that, and maybe we can. Let's prioritize that. You know, let's prioritize that over, you know, all the fripperies and nonsense that we spend money on and invest resources in at the moment. I would like us to be able to keep the internet going so that we can communicate around the world by means of it and so on and so forth. The world in the future will be much more localized, but it would be wonderful if we could continue to communicate with each other around the world. Maybe we can prioritize that, but we're really going to have to make some hard choices. We're not going to be able to have everything. Right? The fantasy of being able to have everything and being able to have more of everything forever, that is exactly what is destroying us. That is exactly what is destroying us. Finally, on the point about indigenous peoples living in harmony with nature, I don't want to over-romanticize. We need to remember, for example, that some of the world's indigenous peoples historically destroyed most of the world's megafauna. Australasia being the classic example, but there are many other examples. How do we square that fact with the fact that it seems that many indigenous peoples who survived today are living in relative harmony with nature? Well, it seems to me that the clue is in the word survive, right? The indigenous peoples who destroyed the megafauna, they either learned from their mistakes and learned to live more harmoniously with nature, or they didn't survive. The question we have to face now is, are we willing to learn from what they learnt ahead of time, ahead of collapsing our future? And I pray that we are. Right, we've got time for a couple more questions. Was there, yes, you, sir.
Is a general strike worthwhile?
Worth considering, yeah. You know, the strike action is obviously itself a specific and very powerful form of direct action. I think that right now it would be completely impossible to call a general strike around this, but maybe at some point, or maybe you think about it a little bit more selectively, right? Are there some sectors where symbolic strikes or temporary strikes could be called, maybe in solidarity with what's going to happen on April the 15th? Well worth considering. And certainly what I think everybody should be considering is, how do we use our labor power or our withdrawal of our labor power as part of what we're talking about here? Absolutely needs to be considered. Thank you.
Yep. I have two questions. The first is, like, are you liaising with unions, first of all, to try and think about how they could help inform a kind of strike? The second, which is what I've actually written, is I was really impressed by your idea of reaching carbon neutral UK by 2025. And I was wondering if you could comment a little more on what kind of changes would need to take place to achieve that. For instance, it would seem to me that people would have to stop driving and trains would have to stop, and there would be no streetlights, and millions of people could potentially lose their jobs. And I was wondering how, like, do you think those are all, I mean, those are things that certainly will be put against you by governments and things like that if you need to get into negotiation with
them. Yeah.
My question sort of follows on from
that. All right. This is really the last question, yeah.
To your knowledge, has anybody started to do any carbon budgeting for the priorities that might get set to reach carbon neutrality by 2025?
Okay, so let me start with that. Has anyone done that in a serious way? No, I don't think they have. I think that'd be a great piece of work to do. And that's the kind of thing that there's so much that's potentially needing to be done in support of the kind of stuff that Extinction Rebellion are trying to do. You know, anyone who wants to kind of volunteer and step forward and help after tonight, you know, do come and talk to me, do come and talk to the UA Extinction Rebellion team here, and I or we can potentially put you in touch with people in the national organization who, for example, might be doing stuff that was in that kind of neck of the woods. Going back to the question about how would this actually be done, and what about some of the downsides of it? Obviously, really important question. Yeah, look, I think if you're going to achieve carbon neutrality by 2025, there's certainly a likelihood you're going to potentially throw millions of people out of work. So how do you deal with that? Well, here's one obvious possible solution. You share the work. We live in one of the most overworked countries in the world. We have huge numbers of people, millions of people, who suffer from systematic stress due to overwork. And then we have millions of people who are unemployed. It shouldn't be beyond the wit of human beings to figure out a way of evening that out. So let's stop doing a lot of the work which is destroying our country and destroying our world, and share out the good work, like, you know, work in the health service and so on and so forth, a bit better. Would we have to shut down trains? No, I don't think, not necessarily. So part of what being net carbon neutral will involve, for example, obviously, is relying a lot more on renewable energy. So in as much as you can run a pretty decent train service in parts of Europe, which is partly powered by renewable energy, we could do more of that here. But we have to make some really hard choices. Yeah, we're going to have to stop doing a lot of motor travel as we know it. Do you remember the old Second World War poster? Is your journey really necessary? You know, that's a good kind of question for the age that we live in. And we'll be needing to think about that on an individual basis, and on a community, and on a community basis, and on a national basis. And this, I think, is the kind of mature conversation that we now need to start to be having. So thanks for raising the question. Rob, over to you.
So can I just thank everyone to give each other a round of applause for standing up. It's not obviously the easiest thing to come and discuss about. So can I just ask everyone...